This is the doctor, the therapist, and the coach on Wire One Radio.
And welcome to another episode of The Doctor, The Therapist and The Coach. Today I'm going to say hello
Gemma,
first.
How are you?
No.
Gem, tell us how
you are, Gemma.
Has this actually just happened?
This has actually just happened.
I'm so excited. Tell me about your day.
Are we going to Angela?
No, because we've gone
And you haven't come to me once in the last two podcasts either. You stole that.
Don't make it mad. Tell her she's picking on me.
Just because you're small doesn't mean that you can get away with this shit any longer.
It does, actually, because I can outrun you. You've got a bad back.
And also, Angela might hit her head when she leans.
My limbs are long enough that I can swipe her from here.
That's true, actually.
I'm like Mr. Tickle.
No, you're like Elastigirl.
I am.
On The Incredibles.
No, literally, I am Elastigirl. Yeah. I'm very bendy and stretchy. Yeah. My cheeks are like...
What an intro. Anyway, moving on. We're all good. We're all saying hi there.
Oh, like a DJ.
What an intro. Oh, gosh.
It's like they're doing that. It's like left the batteries in.
You really do need this to be visible, don't you? We do this on YouTube. You can't do this on a podcast.
No.
Angela, what is the subject of today's podcast?
I believe today we're talking about self-talk.
And Colette, what does that mean?
It's the constant dialogue we have going round and round and round our head, the narrative self.
Are there people that don't have any?
Oh.
There are, yes.
Who are they?
Sometimes acquired brain injury.
Okay.
There are... I mean, the reason I'm hesitating slightly is how would we know?
Yeah.
Good point.
How would
That's
we know?
A very good
so
point.
Someone would have to know that they don't have it, which would mean they'd have to know what it was, or people don't often know what they've not got. So
that's true.
But acquired brain injuries is was one time I would say that I've come up against that.
And Angela, is it something that we learn? Is it something that is given to us? What is it?
I don't know that we know for certain where it comes from, actually. I'm looking at Colette for some kind of backup on this, and she's nodding sagely, going, yeah, I don't think we do know where it comes from.
Yeah,
we can't know, can we? But it's. I think the content of it is influenced by things that come to us, our experiences, particularly when we're young, I would say so.
So if you think about something like a coercive relationship, like a domestic abuse coercive relationship, and that sort of gaslighting behaviour, and you might then sit opposite a woman who will say something, it's always a woman, but who will say something like, oh, it's because I'm useless, I'm rubbish, I'm clumsy, and you think, I'm reasonably sure they're not your words. And that's a narrative that is then onboarded so much that it becomes part of your identity.
Yeah.
And there is a suggestion that maybe that does come from kind of when you're young. So being told all the time that, you know, you're beautiful, that kind of objectifying, you're beautiful, you're whatever, then you may grow up more to feel that.
Do you know, this, I've just had a bit of a flashback of about five years ago when one of the first conversations that we ever had, looking at Colette.
Mm-hmm. Let's drink more water, probably.
Have you only known her 5 years?
No. I'm just thinking that, actually. It's been longer.
You know that we're now in our 40s, when some of us aren't.
I'm 51.
Oh,
you forgot. It's because I look so good for my age.
You do look about 12.
Because I drink so much water.
That's why. However many thousands of years ago we met, I can't remember how many now, you had a conversation about saying about calling a little girl a princess. Do you remember?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was this, aren't you a beautiful little princess?
Yeah.
And then you're sort of giving them a guideline of what they have to
But
become.
Equally, I've just realised I don't think I've ever received those words.
Haven't you?
No. I don't think anyone's ever called me a beautiful little... I'm not little. There's a start.
Someone said to me, and it might have been you, Gemma, I think you and I have had this conversation about what people call you and how they refer to you and how you onboard that. And I'm sure you said to me something like, but you look like all the Disney princesses or something like that.
That wasn't me.
We were talking about Barbie and things like that. We had this long conversation about it. I mean, it must have been you, so I don't talk to anybody else unless it's you, Angela.
It wasn't me.
That kind of, how would I know when I'm in this body, I'm kind of short and everything, that then you're cast like that. You're kind of, you're typecast like that. The conversation was around that kind of, but you look the way people expect you to look. But when you're tall, obviously,
people assign you characteristics I
will get back to the conversation because I can remember it now. But okay. Yeah.
I don't think I get assigned characteristics, or certainly historically wouldn't have been assigned characteristics around vulnerability or, you know, frailty, things like that. I would have been assumed to be capable.
You are slight, though. You're quite fine boned. And I remember the first time I met you, I thought you looked just like Sienna Miller.
Well, that's obvious. Of course I do.
I still do think you look just like Sienna
Miller. You had your eyes like checked recently, Colette. But...
And that self-talk.
I bat them straight back.
That was really interesting.
Faster than a fast bowler.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. We're not going to do therapy on me today. Let's move back to Gemma. What was your self-talk when you were younger?
Well, I tell you what, it was going back to the princess thing. Mm. I have always been a giant human, and I realised that from a very early age. And I think I was around about 8. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was like past your time, and you probably would never have heard of these, but do you remember princess shoes that had an advert for them?
No.
Exactly.
Like Lenny Kelly type.
Remember,
thing.
I was raised by my father.
Right.
And so my feet were too big to wear nice shoes.
Oh, I know the about your feet shoes.
Was,
yeah.
The advert
yeah,
was
told me.
The Secret Garden, a girl in a virtually an elf costume, or not an elf, but a fairy elf costume, was walking through the Secret Garden. She found a shoe, she turned it over, there was a magical key in the sole. And I was like, oh my goodness.
I want shoes like that.
Now, still,
I don't want shoes.
Where does the key go?
Well, exactly. What does it open? I went to Clark's. We went to buy those shoes.
You're becoming emotional.
This is totes emotion. I went to Clark's with my mother. This is one of my childhood traumas. I'm telling you both.
I'm ready to jump around and hug you at any moment.
I appreciate this.
If you want to start, mind your head.
Every time I've stood up in this entire evening that we spent, I've been told, mind your head, back to me being tall again.
Because you nearly knocked yourself unconscious last time.
Tiny bit. No one would notice.
So the advert was amazing. We went to Clark's. They did not do them in my size.
Oh, this is my story of my childhood. Yes, I'm with you.
Right. I could not get the princess shoes. Immediately, I was like, well, I'll just settle for being a troll.
Yes, I love you. I feel you.
Yeah.
None of that shit ever fitted me.
Never.
None of it.
Ever. And that was the outcome of them not doing. And I still, I mean, I've got size 9 feet.
Me too. Well, slightly under. But someone once said to me that if I needed shoes like that, they were like tranny shoes,
that's
a horrible
exactly
pejorative language.
Yeah, exactly.
And I used to hate being taller.
Yeah.
I wouldn't wear heels because I was even more of a giant.
But this then produces, because there is...
We have a therapist in the room and she's doing nothing.
I know, she's just started crying.
I know. It's because you're both my friends and it's so sad. My feet are a size 5.
And we have to... My mum's feet were a size 4. We've talked about this before.
I know we have.
Oh, the layers of... Are we sure we can do this podcast? I'm going to end up needing to go somewhere else.
I'm just going to cry for you.
That's when it all started, I think, because I really... really, really wanted, and it wasn't that I wanted to be a princess, it wasn't a Disney princess.
But you're
it
not
was,
allowed.
It was I wasn't allowed, yeah. And it was that moment, I think, was a really big turning point for me, because it was the moment that it was like, you can't be a princess.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I was like, oh my God, then where do I sit?
Yes.
And what then happens to me? You know, my sister was a ballerina. I tried.
I tried to do ballet.
It wasn't really a gift, was it?
I got a medal for effort.
So I had to do bunny hops because I couldn't cartwheel, and then I left.
I'm pretty sure you don't cartwheel
in ballet. I know that she would love to see me bunny hop across a room because that's my natural state. But still...
Oh my goodness, really?
Yeah, no, there's many of these. This is a lot of stuff that's going to come up in this conversation, oh dear.
Isn't it just? I don't know if we can air this one.
I don't know, this is quite personal.
Well,
but it is exactly that.
Anyone?
there's an age where you don't know how you look to the outside world. So you do think that you could be the Disney princess or the whatever else. And then there's that moment where you start to understand how the rest of the world sees you and it doesn't measure up to your own. Mm. And that is probably where the self-talk starts, actually, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. I know when my mother died when I was young, I suddenly gained a lot of weight. I mean, like, almost overnight. I mean, it wasn't massive by any means, but I certainly gained weight overnight. And people would say, oh, you'd be so pretty if you'd lose some weight. I was 10.
Yeah.
It was like, where does that come from?
And what can you do with it, you know?
Exactly. You can have a lifelong eating disorder.
Internalise it and let it come back and back. Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then it becomes, like, I call them mind movies or mind audios. Yeah.
It's like having a video playing in the background,
constantly
isn't it?
Constantly on. It doesn't help, but it drives the way that you make decisions and how you talk to people and, you know, and how you perform as a human being. I mean, you know, the level of self-talk that I hear in my clinic when people are coming because they want to do something that is out of their ordinary, because they want a coach for that, is, you know, like, I've just seen Colette's face when I told her about my princess shoe story. She was welling up.
I was. You know,
I get it, because when people tell me their moments of, you know, that sort of self-defying moment where it all started, and it's normally from childhood, but it can be from other...
It doesn't have to be childhood.
Big moments in life. But they are the moments that we tend to go over and over and over again. But to say that, though, on the positive side of that, that moment for me was quite defining, and I was looking then for people that I could identify be around, and that was when I found my tribe in the strength community.
That may be where I went wrong. I don't know if I found
maybe
my
you
tribe.
Need to be in my tribe.
Where
you,
are
you
the tall people?
High jumpers.
Okay.
But I would have said your tribe is more your really quite astonishing intellect.
Well, that's, it's the same tribal as everybody said. Bat it back. It's the same as everyone else.
Did you hear that?
It's not.
It so isn't, Angela.
Like,
there is nothing about the way your brain works.
Now I'm
shifting anybody else's.
Well, we're going to be, let's be all really nice to Angela. Well, I think that you're absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. I believe one of the first things I said to you was you look like Sienna Miller, actually.
Yeah.
But your brain is it called sapiosexuality when people are attracted
Are you attracted to my brain, Jen?
I love your brain.
Okay, you're hot too.
Yeah, cheers.
Let's do this.
Not right here, ladies. I'm going to have to put some boundaries in.
I really like is someone with size 9 feet, if I ever mention this to you. Who can pull a truck.
I'm stereotypical Barbie. Can somebody notice me?
You're just sat in the corner crying.
It's because I'm too small. Nobody can see me.
In all seriousness, to your point, interestingly, that became my thing. So when I was younger, you know, I was very much... Oh, God, I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. And actually, everywhere I went, I was quite... When I was bullied at school, it had a very... the component of it was very much about how I looked. So I very much did have that sense that I wasn't okay with how I looked. And so that did become my thing, although I didn't have a tribe. I was just like, well, I'm very clever. I'm going to go to university and I'm going to do a very hard degree and that's what I'm going to do. And I joined Mensa when I was 11 and that was my thing. Yeah. But it was... It's not a thing that... made up for the other things not being there, I think.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the thing.
Absolutely.
And it's when you hear the thoughts that go on in this mind audio that you play, for me, when I learned how to tell the truth, and I know that you guys are like, what is the truth?
There is no such thing as an ontological truth.
Well,
what does ontological mean?
External, so out of your phenomenology. So you see things inside, like from the inside out, and then this desk would be an external truth. It exists outside of the fact that I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I,
the listeners can't.
No, the listeners can't.
We could be screwing with their minds.
Exactly. So they don't know.
It's not blue.
They don't know. It's an ontological truth. But when we experience something, so all three of us could experience, we could see the same thing at the same time.
So we'll agree that it exists.
But we would experience it differently. So our experiencing, which is how we encode memory and things, which is what we go back to for knowledge, that experiencing would be with our own perceptions. So you might say, so like with you, you know, you're easily distracted. So and I might say, oh, have you seen that over there? Gemma's looking behind me and can't see it, and you've left the room to because she just did. So you wouldn't see it anyway. It doesn't mean it didn't happen,
yeah,
but it didn't happen for you to.
It's interesting, though, because I think you were going to say that you found your truth. I think to find your truth, you need a strong enough sense of self.
You do.
To believe your version of the world.
Yeah.
And that isn't something that everybody has.
No.
But it's like every memory you have changes over time. So it's, in my experience, so, you know, the memory that I had from 10 years ago, I spoke very differently about it the week after it happened, 2 weeks after, 6 weeks after, 3 years, nine years.
And you can do that with sort of trauma techniques, can't you? I remember finding that astonishing when we were practicing, when I was training, we learned rewind technique and other sort of changing sensory elements of things that happened to us. When I was doing it, I used a memory of my son having sepsis, and it was as a mum, it was a very scary moment for me. I'd seen lots of children when I was training have anaesthetic, always known I would find that a very difficult thing to watch. And then when it did happen, he was very pale, and the SATS probe wouldn't pick up his, you know, readings and things. It was a very pale, very stark, very cold, scary memory in my mind. And so when I was working through it with my course mate on the course, we turned the colour up. We put the smell of something comforting like vanilla in there. We changed so there was music in the background. And by layer, the sensory qualities were deliberately altered, and the memory is forever slightly altered.
Yeah.
And that's, I was on the way here telling Colette how I was invited onto Good Morning Britain, I think, with Piers Morgan when he did it, to get over my spider phobia. Because they thought it was great that Britain's Strongest Woman was scared of spiders, which I was. Tarantulas, not so scared, but the garden spiders that you find in the garden.
Oh, I've got some, yeah.
The big green bin that I've donated to the Bagby spider community. They scare me a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was similar to the rewind technique that he used, that Pete Cohen used for me. And it was rewinding the moment that I realised that I was scared of spiders. And it was when my mum screamed, you know, like she was being murdered.
Yeah, so my mum had one in her bed once, and I remember that.
Because the spider ran across the room. I was getting my hair, you know, blow-dried. It was Sunday night. I remember it completely. But he made me do the same thing.
Mm.
You know, put something different, put some music, put some smell. And then we went back and we rewound, and it was like, you know, like the boggart in Harry Potter. Change the intensity of it. Make it silly, make it funny.
Yes, yeah,
And it was hugely beneficial to my... I still don't like spiders, and I would still say that I'm still scared of spiders, but I don't have the same reaction to them that I would have had years before.
Yeah, because you're reacting from a trauma that's in, like an embodied trauma.
Yeah. But yeah. And then how that relates to self-talk was that, you know, I used to say to them, how can you be scared of spiders? You're so stupid. That's so... They're not, you know, they don't even have brains. They're not trying to hurt you. There's, you know, the lady that was very enthusiastic about spiders was explaining to me the truth of a spider, her truth of a spider. And I thought, I feel really bad that I'm scared of these things that are just nerve endings, really. But then the negative stuff came in, you know, that's silly to be scared of spiders. You know, it's a
label and
totally
judge.
Rational fear and la, la, la. And then... I had to get rid of those to actually get over to have one crawl on my arm, which
ooh,
I did do.
I just had a tiny little shiver.
Yeah. Now,
I've lost the ability to speak. I'm terrified of spiders.
You are?
I'm absolutely terrified of spiders. And... Yeah.
Do you remember where that came from? Because mine was mother related as well, like Gemma's. She had one in her bed and it scared the shit out of her. And then that was mine kind of. Though I'm better now. I can handle them. Mm. I say handle them. I can use a very, very long handled Hoover, suck them in, keep the Hoover running, put it outside the back door, then Google, and there are journal articles on how long you have to run a spider around a Hoover before it dies. Google that in a journal and then do that 3 or 4 times over. And that, ladies, is handling your fear.
I just scream.
Really?
It's the only thing I can do. Sometimes I faint, like my hands sweat and my eyes go and I start to get palpitations. I'm absolutely terrified of spiders. I've had a huge amount of therapy and I can now just about not pass out if I accidentally see a picture of one.
And do you know where that's from?
No idea.
Okay.
I mean, there is a suggestion that when we have lots of fear, so when we grow up in a way that's quite unsafe,
mm-hmm.
we have to, it's the same as like tokenism or superstition.
Hang
we have
on
to
something.
Put it, yeah, we have to put it somewhere.
Mm.
And that's why it's so extreme. Because I wouldn't say I'm not scared of things. I've got a real catastrophizing mind, but I'm not scared like that of things.
That's really interesting.
Most things, even if I think I'm scared of them, when it actually comes to it, I'm fine. I'd back me in a fight.
And then, yeah, of course. And then what is the self-talk around that fear?
So I know that I am, I know that my body responds when it sees a spider.
Right. So we've gone a bit sideways, which is so unusual with me in the room, but we should lose that technique. But
we'll call Angela Squirrel if anyone's interested. It's because I once said, "Have you got your ducks in a row?" And Gemma said, "No, she's got squirrels at a rave."
So, and I tried to send you a GIF on WhatsApp to demonstrate my brain, and you didn't like it. So I sent you a popcorn machine with little bits of popcorn just falling out every so often, which you think is the most accurate version of my brain.
I sent you a cartoon penguin whose eyes were on swivel.
Wasn't me.
And I changed the name of the WhatsApp group.
Oh, yes, it was supposed to be work, wasn't it? That's so unfair. That's what happened. So self-talk, I tend not to say I am scared of spiders, like in my own self-talk. And I tend to say my body reacts if I come into contact with a spider.
But that's different in a sense to where we were starting with this, which is more like the... Well, it's not. It's a very healthy, good narrative of the situation, isn't it? It's a good sort of very factual description
but
of what's happening.
I am a therapist.
Yeah. And that's what's the most annoying thing about therapists generally, isn't it? They're at the end point of every process. But
yes.
Yeah. The bit that I think a lot of people struggle with, certainly what I hear from a lot of patients, is the constant peppering of self-deprecation through conversation.
I know.
And it in the same way as... You know, it's uncomfortable when you look at your own, but actually when you see other people's, it really is very difficult to hear, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I was listening to a book by...
Being impenetrable sometimes as well.
Is it Deb? I can't remember the surname of the name. It might be Deborah James. I'm not quite sure. No, that was the bowel cancer lady, wasn't it? The lady who had cancer. No, this is the Guilty Feminist podcast.
Okay.
I can't remember her surname. It's escaped me right now. But she wrote a very good book, which was very funny, and I listened to it on Audible. But she did a great sort of bit of stand-up around how effectively self-talk is sometimes
Deborah
like...
Deborah Francis White.
Thank you. You haven't just Googled that. I've seen her live as well, and I still haven't remembered it. But she was talking about how it's like having a serial killer living in your brain. Like you've invited in the most negative, the most awful enemy, actually, to live amongst you rather than having a fan or a friend or somebody who bigs you up. I mean, and I know when I've spoken to you guys sometimes, you've said, well, actually, who's advocating for you?
Yeah.
Who's doing that?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really useful way to look at it is actually in the quiet times when it's just you and this bloody voice, have you got somebody there that is... pushing you down, or have you got somebody there that's got your back? Because we tend to look externally for people to have our backs, don't we? Or to externally to check whether we're okay. Learning to develop that sort of sense of truth is how do you do that? Asking
notice
for
it.
A friend.
You notice it. That's the very first thing you do. So get good, because this goes on constantly all the time, so much so we don't really pay that much attention to it.
It's just your normal.
I've heard a lot of people say it's a bit like having a video running in the background, and sometimes it's louder, sometimes the sound's down, sometimes you're not looking that way, but sometimes it's really loud. So notice it. Notice the words. Actually write them down if you need to. And at this point, don't do anything with it, because when we start to think we have to act, we stop observing.
Well, we resist as well, don't we?
Yeah, we resist. Yeah. So it's a kind of paradoxical field of change. You know, if we don't try and make it change, it will change in and of itself. So notice what the words are and say thank you. Because these words exist for a reason. It's part of keeping you safe. You know, or don't try that because we don't want you to be upset. And you might, you know, or don't think that about yourself because... I know as women, certainly of my generation, it was always don't be too much. You know, don't be too proud. Don't be
really
too loud.
Really difficult when you've got size 9 feet and you're 6 foot tall and you can pull a truck, isn't it, Gemma?
Did I get
activated then?
No, you were activated then.
Sorry.
You were activated then. Well, you know, if you're clever, I got the biggest score on the test. Well, don't show off. People won't like you. Those kind of things. And they're the voices and they're there to keep us safe. And it's worked. we're still here, we've survived, so it's worked, and we're surviving, but are we thriving?
Yeah, but what do they stop you from doing?
Taking risks, getting hurt, being seen, doing anything
walking
different.
Walking into a gym.
Walking into a gym,
one of the biggest thing, and, you know, I own a gym, but I still don't like gyms. I mean, I love mine, but I would never, you know, if you said to me, shall we go on a gym day? I'd say, I'm all right, thanks. I've got one. It's not an environment that I like because it's so synthetic and it's not a natural place, you know. And but that's my self-talk because I trained in a gym and I'm an empath. I feel how everybody feels. And and sometimes it's like, you know, going to a shopping supermarket. If you walk past a shop and you see somebody really happy coming out, then you feel that I feel their happiness. If you see somebody
mirror
coming
neurons.
Out that has just failed on fitting into a size 12 pair of jeans, then they are sad. And I feel all of that.
I always say that. I feel like I've got a layer of skin missing. I'm a bit porous almost. Yeah.
And I think that it's that self-talk that, and I really, really can't be in shopping centres or these sorts of places because I hear it, I feel it. And it's, I hear that self-talk.
So being a therapist, people will just tell you.
Yeah.
I've got like a Labrador face. Everyone tells me everything.
Yeah. And then when people come to me and they ask me to make them stronger, you know, I have to know, well, I don't have to know, but we have to get out all of that self-talk. Because if you want to increase your strength, what do you have to let go of? And that's the, you know, self-talk for me is what I do on a daily basis, because
so letting go of it is almost letting go of your safety rope. It's that it's that thing.
And
is
you
it?
Don't
it's
have to make it
what
go
weighs
away.
You down.
We're not needing to make it go away. We're just needing to answer it. So I've got a name for mine. She's called Mavis.
Nice.
Thank you. And I often think, oh,
hello, Mavis.
Thank you.
Mine has
the same message. It always will always have, which is they don't love you. They don't love you.
Mavis sounds like a complete quit. I mean, I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, well, you just did.
Thank you. It's all right. We'll
bleep it.
But that's because of the way I was raised. So that's my earliest encoding. And if you don't expect them to love you, then you simply can't be rejected and you won't be hurt because that's dangerous to you. So I'm like, oh, Mavis, hello. Thank you. You know, what we tend to do is, so say there might be a situation where maybe I'll pull up somewhere and there's a group of women I kind of loosely know and they're all together and Mavis will go, don't get out. They are not your friends. Don't. Do you remember when you were in year five and you didn't get picked for the netball team? I'm 51, for God's sake. But I remember in that moment,
absolutely.
I remember, and I don't want to get out of my car. But what actually happens then is I've not got out of my car and joined that group of women who really don't know anything about my year five experience with netball, and now they're wondering what am I that I'm not even getting out of the car to speak to them. And we build these self-fulfilling behaviors. So instead of that, it's a real question of, hi Mavis, thanks, but actually I am going to get out of the car and go and say hello and see how it goes. And maybe it won't go well, and maybe I will know that next time, and I might not see those people again next time, but maybe I will, because an old map, you know, this old map, like an old AA route map, doesn't tell us what's coming.
Well,
it only tells us what we were.
Yeah. And it's like having a very old version of yourself, a very young version of yourself running your business life, your relationship, your sex
Who's
life.
Who's driving
your,
the bus?
Yeah, absolutely.
But also, not just that, who are you passing this on to?
Absolutely.
You know, one of the biggest gratitudes I have in my life is that I had two boys. And not two girls.
Yeah,
I've got three girls.
You've got three girls, and I just I I'm not saying that it's easy to be a boy or anything. I'm not getting into that discussion, but from me as a parent and as a single parent, I have found it so joyful seeing how I have not had to or even had the opportunity to pass on my self-talk about, you know, my princess
But you're not
shoes.
The only person responsible for that. I think what I've been really aware of with my daughter is how it's, if you don't have a counter somewhere to the message you're getting, then it really does bed in. So, and it, you know, my parents loved me because my dad's no longer with us, but loved me a great deal. But some of the messages that I received when I was growing up was still around my sheer size, or, you know, because my mum was 5'1", you know, it was, what the hell was that about, that she had a daughter the size of me? That is a bit bloody weird. And so, but some of those messages were there about my sort of discomfort, about my sheer sort of height and size and feet and all the rest of it. But because I had a similar sort of message at school, there was no counter to that. There was no other place for that. But with my daughter, she's in a really supportive group of friends at school. And it's just, it's actually quite bittersweet to see someone else go through. You might have this with your kids as
I do.
To see them go through that happily, actually, and getting into relationships that are supportive. Yeah. And
my
youngest
particularly.
She
sits in that space. My middle daughter is much more... she's more of an outlier, and sometimes I know she was excluded from something a year or so ago, and I felt it back to a previous life.
She
didn't care, but I felt it back to a previous life, because it, my voice
breaks,
is always,
me to hear my children get bullied, and
it's always that, you know, you won't be included, this isn't for you, this isn't yours, you don't belong here, you know, you won't be safe. But if you can follow that train of voice and think, well, what's the driver, what are you trying to tell me, and actually it's trying to tell you, this is how to stay safe. I don't want you hurt like that again.
And so, you need those new experiences, don't you,
always,
to do it?
Thank you, Mavis. But actually, I'm gonna have a good look. Is it a feeling or a fact? That's a really good question to ask yourself. Is this a feeling or a fact? You know, do those ladies the other side of my car really want to enact my fifth year humiliating netball not being picked for the team experience? you know, I very much doubt it. You know.
One of my friends who is a therapist was talking about shame, actually, but described it in a really nice way and said, you know, what's your gut? What's the message from your gut? What's the message from your heart?
Yeah.
And then what's your head telling you? And I think sometimes if you can do a scan in that way, you can unpick a little bit the layers of, because it is, I sometimes explain it in my not a proper therapist way, although I did get told off for saying that I wouldn't be a therapist because, again, back to my self-talk, but where was I going to go with this?
I've got no idea.
Explaining things to people, but no, it's gone.
Oh.
Rewind. What was I saying? Were you two not even listening?
No, you were talking about your therapist friend.
Yeah, I talked about him, about shame and things, but I can't remember where I was going to go after that.
Well, one thing that I do, especially when I'm taking somebody from a very negative self-talk system approach, to how they view themselves, because and you know, in the previous podcast we were talking about addictions being problematic when they start to cause harm. I believe that self-talk is probably one of the negative self-talk that I hear in people can be the most harming thing that we have, because it
certainly
can prevent
limiting
for sure, and it can prevent so many things, you know. It can,
that's where I was going to go with it. Yeah, I was going to say it's effectively like having your raincoat on, isn't it? Even on a sunny day, I think there's that bit of your brain that is constantly scanning the environment, all that sensory input that's coming in, so that, you know, what's the situation, what's the mood, what are those people doing, is there a fire in the corner, you know, constantly getting the sensory input. But the wiring is faster down to your smoke detector than it is up to the bit of you that makes sense of it. And so what's really difficult sometimes is to understand that your immediate reaction, your gut feeling, your sense that you shouldn't actually needs to be just pause just for a split second.
Yeah.
Just give it a minute, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and then
one of my
that's why I say hello, Mavis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just that second. Just that.
Thank you for sharing.
You're
but
welcome.
Today we are something else. It's like I have this.
I thought that was the end of the podcast. I thought you were wrapping up.
I thought we had a proper time up then, didn't you?
Yeah.
No. It's like, no, we're just turning the lights off. Goodbye.
Jeez.
Whoa.
We haven't finished yet.
No, I thought there was loads more that we were going to go.
But what I was, I have the book that I use as a reference guide to in the majority of my seminars that I perform. And it's my first book of opposites from the Osborne Guide. And it's big, small, up, down, black, white, on, off.
Yep.
And it is the most simplistic form of how to change and adapt self-talk. So if you have 10 movies, 10 mind movies that you go to, like your netball, year five netball,
year five
exclusion,
netball.
You know, that's the mind movie. We get to the word that describes that experience. and what that word is for you, right? And this is a game that I play. It's not therapy, it's a game. And then you try on for size what the opposite of that is.
Someone said that to me, or it was some meme recently that was saying, if you spend a lot of your time thinking about the worst case scenario, for goodness sake, at least just give yourself a second to think about what would happen if it was... And we do that scaling, don't we, a lot, where we say, okay, so you think you're the ugliest woman in the room. Well, sit down on this wall and, you know, quietly, without letting other people know that you're doing it.
Every third person.
Yeah, just measure yourself a little bit. Try and be...
Yeah, but every third person, because we have comparison bias.
Yeah, yeah, so yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Every third person.
And, sorry, go on.
No, that's all. That it is that kind of, I'm the fattest person. Well, are you? Let's look at every third person. And are you actually objectively bigger or smaller than that person?
I know that you guys were talking about that there is no truth, but I am a massive advocate of telling the truth. I believe that there are three sides to every story. There is my side, there is your side, and then there's the truth. And it's the middle bit, it's the truth that I'm looking for to get to.
See, I think it's a perspective thing. And actually, it's one of my biggest problems is because I am an empath or whatever I am, I find it very, very difficult to know what I think about something, because I can so easily second and third position and kind of imagine somebody else's view on it, that actually that can feel quite rudderless for me sometimes about knowing what way to go with something.
I always think to myself that the person I'm with deserves the respect of knowing what I truly believed in that moment. So if I'm second guessing them, first of all, I've got no right walking around someone else's thoughts like that, and how arrogant is that? But if you ask me something, Jen, you I would give you the respect of telling you what my view is.
I don't think it's that simple. I think that's about managing your environment. So I think that's my tendency towards that, I think, still dates back to how are those people going to react to me, and what do I need to say to make sure it's okay?
It's the shoes. It's the size 9 shoes.
Yeah, well, it's all
size
those things.
Green shoes.
Yeah.
They
weren't
shoes.
Green. They didn't have anything in a nice colour like that.
Really?
Yeah, but I think because some of those things are... You know, and you can work on those things, but you were saying you have mind movies, but you've got to bear in mind that for some people there aren't the movies. They don't even quite remember the thing that's set, you know.
If it's set in a complex trauma.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Thing after thing after thing.
And I think that self-talk isn't really given any airtime until it stops you from doing something. Mm. So until it actually, you know, somebody comes to me and they're not getting any stronger. Well, what is it that's preventing you? Well, I can't do that. Well, I have a young guy that's just joined, and he's a race car driver, and a young 13 to 16 year old race car. And I've banned the word can't because I needed a very specific way to very quickly apply a non-negative framework to the training that we were doing, because, you know, he has things that he is, you know, hurdles that he's up against, but at the same time, every single time I hear the word can't, he gets a 50 burpee fine, because I as a coach need that out so that we can do something. But then I have another client that I say, are you having a can day or a can't day? Because one day she'll be able to come, you know, the lady's in her 70s, one day she's like, actually I can do this today, and then the next day she's not slept very well, so she can't do it. And it's acceptable. It's not that I ban the word can't completely, but it's in sometimes it's helpful and sometimes it's not.
Sometimes I interrupt people when they're in clinics, or when I get, I'll tell them I'm going to do it. I'll say, right, well, today I'm going to interrupt you every single negative self-comment you get. We don't get far in those sessions.
Yeah,
I mean, it is every 2 or 3 seconds.
The stories. Yeah. I had a patient, absolutely. And it's just drawing attention, like you say, a lot of change, isn't it, is notice, first of all.
And you can start by doing it for, so if you model it, so like I will often say, thank you for waiting for me. I'm sorry I'm late, or something like that. And you begin to model that. You begin to model, I'm quite well known for saying thank you. If someone says you look nice, or you look, oh God, thank you, I'm spectacular. And I've actually had people say to me, it's really nice to hear a woman say that.
Yeah.
Because it's so unusual. And obviously, you both know my youngest daughters, and they would do that. They'll say, no, we're amazing. We're warriors, you know.
Yeah.
Do you want to come along for the ride? And that is when I think we begin to make change, because it's an allowing. It's allowing another voice in there, another perspective in there.
Yeah. So if from each of our chairs, let's say, somebody comes to you and you see that self-talk is causing harm, discomfort, problems, you know, in sexual function, that must be huge. You know, in therapeutic terms and coaching terms, what would we give them? How would we apply our knowledge to them?
Mine is always notice the voice.
Notice and say hello.
I just been called Sydney Banks' three principles sometimes. That can help. But actually, just notice the voice. I mean, CBT would fit in that model as well, I guess. But all of that comes later. Mm-hmm. What we want is to make friends with all parts of ourselves.
Yeah.
Where we are now today.
Yep. Angela?
It's not that different, actually, because I work on, you know, I'm taught in similar
copycat.
Sort of... Sorry?
Copycat.
I don't want to be in the middle of this. Look, she's a sad person now.
Pulling that face now. I've not forgotten the beginning of this podcast. I've not forgotten.
Nothing to say, nothing to add. Nothing.
But no, I think, you know, our own self, from my coaching perspective, it's when it prevents you from being the... I know this is going to sound really cliche, but... the best version of what you have asked to become.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you're seeing that you've had nine, you know what I'm like with my three shelves and three boxes on each shelf. You've got nine goals.
I've been one of your boxes on the shelf.
You
I know what that feels like now. I know. I am one of your boxes.
and if you're seeing no improvement whatsoever on any of those shelves, what is it? That's going wrong, and I immediately say, what are the noises in your head?
Yeah.
What's going on inside of you? And let's have a look at that.
I think it's a really good question. I think from a sex perspective, it's so multi-layered because obviously there are lots of physical things that can be impacting, but there's inevitably a bleed between the two. Before I was taught properly about sexology, I was given this false distinction, as we often are, between, you know, that these are body-based, these are organic things. This guy's got an organic cause for his erectile dysfunction. It's because his blood vessels are getting furred up, and that's what it is. This guy's got performance anxiety, and it's just that. But of course it bleeds, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because if you've lost your erection once and that was embarrassing and you felt, you know, belittled in that situation, suddenly a small section of you is watching the next time. What's happening? Is it okay? It seems okay. I think we're all right. We're okay. But, you know, you're spectating a little bit. So most of what I work with people in terms of sexual function has a thing that's happening and then the meaning about the thing that's happening. And I'm working in both of those places. And just like Colette, even though it's not really copying, it's just using, you know, evidence-based techniques that work.
I'll copy you instead. Okay?
Perhaps we're just coherent and cohesive in what we're doing.
I think we are.
Possibly.
You talk about scripting a lot as well, don't you?
Yeah, well, scripting is difficult. Scripting is more, well, there's all sorts of different ways of describing scripting, but scripting tells us what we should be doing a lot of the time, actually. And that means, and most of the time with my patients, they've never considered that the way that they think about sex or normal or vanilla or kink or the amount of times or whatever that's come from. Where has that come
but
from?
But that can become self-taught. We upload it, we encode it as our own, and it's not.
So, but the same principle of, first of all, you have to notice it. And I think that's what we don't do. We're completely unconscious in the beginning. And then in the middle of noticing it, it's all an effing mess and you don't quite understand what you're doing. And then there comes the bit where you start to gain a little bit of control over what happens.
Yeah. Well, ladies, thank you very, very much for another lovely, wonderful podcast about self-talk today. Thank you very much. And we will see you for another Doctor, Therapist and Coach podcast.
And Mavis.
Mavis has joined the party. Say hello and notice. Goodbye.
Bye.